broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman live on your radio. Hard-hitting news the networks refuse to use, no doubt, continues now. This is the broadcast for March 23rd in the year of our Lord, 2023. This is hour two of two in the goal, always to protect life, liberty, and property, to promote God, family, and country, to do so on your radio in the traditions of our founding fathers. Yes, indeed, we use the blueprint for liberty, the supreme law of the land, the Constitution for the United States of America. In that document, there are checks and balances, ladies and gentlemen. That is the key to our restoration, using the checks and balances to make America great again. We can do it, and we need your help. We reject revolution. We stand for peaceful restoration of the greatest country on the face of the earth. And like clockwork, Pete Sepp, president of the National Taxpayers Union, NTU.org. Welcome back, my friend.
Always great to be here.
There's so much to discuss, so little time. It seems like everybody's distracted, but the debt ceiling reality is coming, and it's coming like a freight train. And everybody's, in my opinion, guilty of dereliction of duty while they're absolutely distracted with the most mundane stuff. It's not even funny, Pete.
Yeah, I mean, what can be more important than the fiscal future of this country? And members of Congress would rather talk about anything else. That's a problem. I mean, the debt ceiling is obviously a controversial topic. There are plenty of folks who are well-meaning who say, well, we don't want to come anywhere close to testing the creditworthiness of the United States of America. On the other hand, we have to be very careful and mindful of what brought us here. And, you know, Barack Obama, when he was president, used to say that not approving a debt ceiling increase is like getting a big bill at a restaurant after eating a fine meal and just skipping out on it. Well, failing to figure out why we're overspending and just approving the debt ceiling willy-nilly is like getting that bill at the restaurant and handing it to a kid in a high chair at the table next to you. That's just as bad. We have to think of both problems here and deal with them accordingly.
I bring that up because, you know, the National Taxpayers Union is one of the greatest think tanks in the country, providing solutions, not just problems, but highlighting concerns, highlighting difficulties we face, but then providing real think tank answers and solutions and productive ways to improve things. You guys have been working on this kind of stuff. And I think that this translates into a broader discussion than just the debt ceiling, does it not?
Yeah, it certainly does. It translates into a discussion about President Biden's budget that was recently submitted to Congress, translates into discussions about how we portray the national debt and our federal spending and revenue picture to the average American taxpayer. That's the job of the Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management and Budget. It translates even into the state and local level, where, frankly, there's a lot more innovation in fiscal policy going on than what you see at the federal level. Some of it bad, but a lot of it good. And Washington, D.C. needs to start learning those lessons from their colleagues at lower levels of government. I wouldn't even call them lower levels of government. That's kind of an insult. I would say levels of government closest to the people who want to make a difference in the way governments spend money and tax.
All right, I want to talk about this a little bit. What are they going to do for the debt ceiling? Kevin McCarthy is going to extract a few token whatevers and they're just going to shove it through. Is that what's on the docket?
I'm not so sure. I think that this is going to be a very important moment for many folks in the GOP on the House side, especially, who have said, look, Kevin McCarthy is speaker because we have demanded certain things to happen prior to any increase in the federal debt ceiling. That includes significant reductions in federal spending. It includes votes on things such as a constitutional amendment to require a balanced budget going forward. I'm all for those kinds of votes, as a practical matter, those votes will not get the two-thirds majority needed to send those amendments to ratification in the states. So really, we need to focus on the here and now, which is winning important budget process reforms that are bipartisan and having an honest discussion that results in a serious slowdown in federal spending. I'm not even thinking that there needs to necessarily be massive cuts, although that's what some members of the GOP are talking about. Just roll things back to fiscal year 22 levels. That doesn't seem to be too heavy of a lift, considering that in fiscal year 2022, we were still spending a whole lot of money on pandemic relief. Defense spending was increasing, entitlement spending was increasing. I don't see how it should be that difficult for Washington, D.C. to say, you know what we were doing a year and a half ago? Let's just do that again and learn to live with a little bit less.
All right. I find that interesting because there's so many line items we can discuss and so many details we can discuss. But the fundamentals are simple, Pete. We have got to decrease government programs. We've got to decrease spending. And I think if we just really went through in a real serious exercise, Donald talked about it but never really did it holistically like he could have. But look, every department simply needs to say, look, you're going to cut 10% of your budget. You're going to find ways to do it that's the least impactful. Get it done. Provide a report. We could take action and not even feel it in a serious way, Pete.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And in fact, we've already done some of that work on a bipartisan basis. There's an exercise we go through with an organization called the U.S. PIRG, Public Interest Research Group, Education Fund. They describe themselves as a left-of-center organization. So these are not super conservative folks. And yet we managed to identify hundreds of billions of dollars in spending reductions that we could both agree upon. Let's start eliminating the Asia Foundation, the East-West Center also. That's $357 million. Reform how the U.S. Mint has its composition of metals in coinage, $150 million. Eliminate certain payments in the Abandoned Mine Restoration Program, $1.15 billion. There are dozens of recommendations here across all kinds of federal spending, including defense spending, that we could agree upon. Here's a blueprint to start with. Members of Congress may not enact it all. They may come up with other ideas, but here's how to get the conversation going.
And that's really the quintessential point, because everybody's kind of going into this literally staking out their positions. For example, Kevin McCarthy's like, hey, Social Security, Medicaid, Medi-Cal, none of that's even on the table for discussion. Well, they've got to do something or the system won't be able to continue to run long term. So I don't see how we start staking out these positions of untouchables, if you will, third rail of politics kind of an idea. If we do that and we take too much off the table, we can't take off foreign aid. Oh, we can't take off national defense. Oh, we can't take off education. Oh, we can't take off. Pretty soon, there's nothing left to discuss that's meaningful.
Yes, that's
exactly
right.
Am I crazy on this?
No, not at all. And the crazy thing is, as you were just alluding to, Sam, Social Security is going to have troubles on its own automatically. In less than 10 years, we are facing a meltdown of the so-called trust fund. We could do a whole show on why there's no trust and no fund there, but let's use Washington's language here. When that happens, when Social Security can no longer pay out all of its promised benefits, when all of the interest payments the trust fund has received have run out, there will be an immediate one-third reduction in benefits unless Congress acts. So Social Security is going to get cut automatically if Congress does nothing. Shouldn't Congress do something that's a little more conscious, a little more thoughtful now so that we avoid that kind of outcome?
Wow. You know, when you think about that, it's something that either we will decide intelligently. In other words, we will be intentional about this, or it's just going to run over us like a freight train, and it's going to be a, in my opinion, nothing but a disaster, a fiasco. I mean,
yeah.
There's not really an in-the-middle choice, is there?
No, there isn't. You know, there are, I'm sure, some members of Congress who think, well, you know, the year before the whole thing goes bust, we'll just raise payroll taxes. And you think, okay, by how much? Well, about the same amount you'd see with the automatic benefit cut, one third. What would that do to America? What would that do especially to low-wage workers? You know, they're not necessarily paying federal income taxes of any consequence, but right off the top, the very first dollar they earn has upwards of 12.4% taken out for Social Security taxes. The so-called employee share is half. The so-called employer's share is the other half. But really, it's the employee that pays both halves. That's what we face as a crisis. Do you want to have an extra 4% taken off the top of your paycheck? I don't think so.
Pete Sepp with me, ladies and gentlemen, president of NTU.org, the National Taxpayers Union. You know, this topic is so large. People don't know where to start. Let's talk about where the conversations should start and what components are a must, shall we?
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas, like this year's Buckaroo calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
I think that my family has always had a big influence on me for not smoking because since I was little, I was taught that smoking was wrong.
Recent studies indicate that smoking among teens often leads to the use of alcohol and other drugs.
I think having faith in God is a big part in it because the way I was raised has helped to avoid smoking.
Smoking. If you think you're old enough to start, you're smart enough to stop. A public service message from this station and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Live and on your radio, Sam Bushman, Pete Sepp, National Taxpayers Union, NTU.org. So really, the topic is so massive, it's hard to know where to start. Where do we start with this kind of discussion to bring people together as opposed to just stake out your positions and die on that hill? How do we bring people together? Where do we start the conversation? And what are musts in the conversation, Pete?
Well, I think we can start here by looking at the work of the United States Senate Budget Committee. There you had in a previous Congress, Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, who is now the chair of the Senate Budget Committee. And you had Mike Enzi, Republican from Wyoming. He has since passed away, but several years ago, they came up with an entire budget process reform plan, things like a biennial budget, meaning that money gets appropriated in one year And then they spend the second year reviewing how the money was spent in depth. That's a change to the current process where Congress just lets the money fly out the door every year and has very little follow-up. There are many other points of that budget process reform that involve the president, that involve things such as sequestration. I mean, those are all very important, highly technical things, but they're a good place to start. Then we take a look at some of these bipartisan budget recommendations for specific spending items. Some of the NTU Foundation and U.S. PIRG report that I mentioned in the last segment, that would be a good place to start. But there are still other bills. The Preventing Improper Payments Act, that's sponsored by Utah's own Congressman Blake Moore and a Democrat from Virginia, Abby Spanberger. That would automatically designate all federal programs making more than $100 million in payments a year as susceptible to significant improper payments, and that would subject the program to enhanced reporting requirements. So that's kind of an early warning system. You've got fair value accounting, which is a way that portrays properly federal credit and loan programs. The current way of reporting it makes them appear a lot cheaper than they really are. That's Congressman Ralph Norman, Republican from South Carolina, and Ed Case, who's a Democrat from Hawaii. There's plenty of other bills like this where Democrats and Republicans have gotten together, and I think those are good places to start.
I think one of the things that really put a fly in the ointment, so to speak, are these people, the majority leader, the minority leader, the this, the that, the speaker, the... It seems like a lot of people really want to work on this, and people have really good hearts and genuine desires and real solutions and efforts they put on the table. What happens, though, is one or two people, three people, whatever you want to say, literally control the schedule, control the docket, and to the point where it never gets anywhere. I think we've really got to start to change that narrative as well, because we're governing by the few at the expense of the many.
Yes, that's exactly right. We hear that from legislative staff all the time when we say, well, look at all of these lists of bills. I mean, we've even called them by what their name should be, no-brainers. Every year we come up with 10, even a dozen pieces of legislation that are bipartisan in nature and ought to be easy to pass given how many co-sponsors they've got. And we hear back from staff saying, well, but the floor calendar for debate is really tight this year. We don't think we're going to be able to get to it because we've got too many more important things like appropriations bills ahead of them. And that's when we say, well, that's crazy, because all of these things can help to control appropriations to a better degree and keep us from getting so close to this debt ceiling in a repetitive fashion. So they need to find the time, and they need to use the time they have more constructively. That's all you have to do. Why in the world do we have this year-end spectacle annually where Congress in the last 2 weeks of the session in December is suddenly debating trillions of dollars in new spending and trillions of dollars in taxes? It should be more deliberative and thoughtful throughout the year. It's the most important thing that Congress does is fiscal policy.
And there's two ways to go about improving the nation's financial wherewithal or financial stability or whatever you want to call it, financial outlook. There's a lot of words that highlight the point I'm making here. But one way is for government to reduce spending. And I think that's a given, must, absolutely must happen, or the train's a rolling and we're going to get crushed. But the other way, which people don't think about much, is this. We could make government more efficient to where it didn't, in a backhanded way, steal more money off my financial plate, Pete. And let me explain and then have you respond. I right now file my taxes. But when I do, I have to have a CPA look at it because I have businesses and all this stuff. I have to spend a ton of money gathering information, getting it in a format with a bookkeeper that all the CPAs can look at and determine. Then the CPAs have got to be caught up every year. Then I spend a chunk of money on getting my taxes even filed. When I'm done, I'm not even confident that it's done right. I sure hope so, but I don't know. So I kind of live in a little bit of trepidation and fear, but I've spent a bunch of money on it. The amount of time and expense that it takes to get all that done. And I look at it and I say, if we could just fix that. I don't have any problem paying my fair share. I really don't. I have a problem, though, with what it takes to do my fair share. When I get done, I'm exhausted. I want to go out to dinner and celebrate because I'm just like, holy crap, it's over finally once again. I hope I'm out of Dodge. Wow. But they could literally change this game and do apportionment taxes. The states would then just be apportioned. You wouldn't need to track it on an individual basis. There'd be nothing to discuss. If there's 3 million people in the state of Utah, hey, we have 3 one-millionths of the whole 330 million piece of that pie on the federal level and on the state level. We could do apportionment taxes. We could do tariffs at the borders to where none of the taxes were direct. It could be so simple. It's just a no-brainer discussion. We could solve this. And if we did, I would literally receive a rise in my available time given back to me and in my income literally instantly. And then I wouldn't live in fear at all either. Isn't this doable, Pete?
It is doable, and in fact, it's quantifiable. Every year, we put out an analysis of tax complexity. In other words, how much time does the private sector spend just trying to comply with the U.S. tax laws at the federal level, not state and local, just the federal level? And how much money do we spend out of pocket on things like tax software or accounting services? In the last year that we had done that analysis, the total compliance burden of the federal income tax system is conservatively estimated at $339 billion with a B dollars. That does not even account for the value of your time placed somewhere else. It's only the value of your time averaged out as to what the typical private sector compensation is. Imagine all the innovation that could happen with all this free time, or more time you have to spend with your families. Your kids become better adjusted, better educated, more time you can spend helping out your church. All of these things have a value in them that we've not even calculated. My guess would be that we could easily put $500 billion, $500 billion back into the economy with a simpler tax system. Imagine that, a $500 billion a year stimulus, if you will, and not $1 of it would come from taxpayers. It would be coming back to taxpayers.
What do you think of my general jettisoning of direct taxation and saying apportionment taxes at the state and the federal level, along with, excise taxes or taxes that are at the border, tariffs and things like that? You could have no direct taxes on the people. You wouldn't have to monitor anybody. You wouldn't have. Right now, they've basically turned. At first, people are like, oh, sales tax would be awesome. But now that I study the sales tax with a lot that's going on, now you're basically charged in every single county and city. And I mean, it takes a rocket scientist mammoth piece of high tech technology to even comply with all the different rules that have come from this sales tax state by state, jurisdiction by jurisdiction discussion. It's not even funny. Compliance is super expensive if you can get it done at all, Pete.
Yeah, that's right. And you'd have another benefit from indirect taxes, Sam, because the founders recognize this. Indirect taxes make the federal government automatically more accountable to the states and the people. It's a little harder to play funny money with indirect taxes than direct ones. We would have a smaller, more transparent federal government as well.
I don't even know these days that small businesses can be compliant with the taxes and the rules and the jurisdictions. I don't even think it's possible without great expense and a third party helping them. And even then, it's dubious at best. We'll talk about that with Pete Sepp in seconds. You are listening to the one and only Liberty Roundtable Live.
Pursuing liberty, using the Constitution as our guide. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Lance Pry. The Federal Reserve, fighting for the financial system in the United States, continued to fight inflation by raising the interest rate banks pay for money another quarter percentage point yesterday. At least one person is injured after an F1 tornado ripped through Montebello, California in East Los Angeles. This high school student was in class when the tornado hit.
All of a sudden, we open the door a little bit, and then we just see like a gust of wind starting to build up, and then it just like got faster and faster.
The National Weather Service confirmed the unusual tornado touched down Wednesday morning. 17 structures were damaged. The tornado stayed on the ground between 2 and 3 minutes and had a maximum wind speed of 110 miles per hour. The Manhattan, New York grand jury investigating former President Trump's role in a non-disclosure agreement payment to Stormy Daniels was instructed not to meet Wednesday. The district attorney's office notified court officials about the change in plans. The grand jury is now scheduled to reconvene today. At least 68 people across the United States are now known to have been infected by contaminated eye drops, killing 3, blinding 8, and leaving 4 others needing an eyeball surgically removed. The over-the-counter drops by AriziCare and Delsum Pharma, first recalled in February, have now been linked to cases in 16 states. The CDC reissued the warning this week. Nearly 200 years after Ludwig von Beethoven's death, researchers at the University of Cambridge pulled DNA strands from Beethoven's hair, searching for clues about health problems that plagued him. They did find a genetic risk for liver disease plus a liver-damaging hepatitis B infection in the last months of his life. These factors, along with chronic drinking, were probably enough to cause liver failure and his death in Vienna 168 years ago this Sunday. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. We are USA News.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and I have a question for you. You know that unwelcome guest everyone wishes would just leave already? That's COVID-19. That's why I got an updated booster designed to help protect against recent Omicron variants. Got it? Check eligibility and schedule your updated COVID booster at vaccines.gov. Sponsored by Pfizer and BioNTech.
Hi, this is Joe Cordell with the law firm Cordell & Cordell. When the prospect of divorce becomes a reality, you need a partner that you can count on. If you're a man in this situation, consider contacting Cordell & Cordell. We've helped men navigate complex legal matters for 30 years.
Contact Cordell & Cordell to schedule an appointment with one of our firms online at CordellCordell.com. No representation is made that the quality of legal services to be performed is greater than the quality of legal services performed by other lawyers. Online at CordellCordell.com. CordellCordell.com.
All right, Pete Sepp with me, National Taxpayers Union, NTU.org. So really, I submit to you this tax compliance issue is a big one. People are just ran around to death. I don't know that a small company can even get started and be tax compliant. There's so much money spent. It's so difficult. I've worked as an IT consultant for small business, and it's very, very, very tough for them to get compliant. It's expensive, and it's dubious if they can even get it done and feel good about it. Pete?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the $80 billion of additional funding the IRS just received will not, I repeat, will not help the matters without serious guardrails and taxpayer protections. You know, when Congress passed that additional funding in the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, I say so-called because it's done nothing for inflation except make it worse. When that passed, all Congress really wanted out of it, and here it's the Democratic caucus, not the Republican one, all they wanted out of it was to hit a revenue target. They thought, well, $80 billion in additional funding, pour it into enforcement, we'll probably get 3 or 4 times that much money back in revenues. I don't think that's actually going to happen. I think, number one, the government itself doesn't understand the tax law much more than taxpayers do. Number two, putting all that money in enforcement resources doesn't necessarily guarantee a return because there are taxpayers willing to defend themselves in court. Number three, the Internal Revenue Service has a history of bad record keeping, failing to meet its own internal management deadlines, not updating its own IT systems. So all of that's going to weigh pretty heavily against them collecting what they hope to collect from this additional $80 billion. And just as we were discussing, Sam, think of all the additional stress that this is going to put on small businesses. They're going to be thinking even more about how they could possibly comply with this mountain of tax paperwork. Nobody will be safe, not big businesses, not small ones.
And it's not, again, it's not that we don't even want to pay. It's that it's so impossible to do so and to comply. It's financially difficult. It's a nightmare. Look, there's thousands of jurisdictions in America with different taxing details. There's already 3,000 plus counties in the country, not to mention all the cities in different jurisdictions. And some cities even have different tax codes. I mean, it is a nightmare. There's a couple other things I want to ask you about. I know you got to fly at the end of this segment, Pete, so I want to get a couple of these things in. There's an article that talks about a coalition letter to support anti-claw legislation. Nicholas John's on your website that's really important for people to learn about. Pete?
Oh, yes, indeed. What these are, the PLAs, that's project labor agreements. And project labor agreements are basically union-sponsored provisions that create a condition of winning construction contracts whenever federal taxpayer funds are involved. In other words, if you give a grant with federal taxpayer money to do something with the Department of Defense, a new weapons system, or build a road, or engage in a transit project, it has to be done with union labor. And that requires contractors to sign a collective bargaining agreement with workers if they want to get the taxpayer funds. And of course, there might be many listeners who say, well, okay, why shouldn't a contractor pay a fair wage? Well, there's a difference sometimes between a fair wage and a union inflated wage. And a union inflated wage doesn't always benefit workers. In fact, if the wage goes so high that the contractor can't necessarily afford to hire as many people, workers can actually lose out. I mean, that's what I've been saying for years with increases in the federal minimum wage. Yes, sure, they will boost the wages of millions of workers, but it will also lay off millions of workers as businesses say, well, okay, if I have to pay you $15, $20, $25 an hour, fine, but my workforce is now going to shrink from 5 to 4 or 5 to 3. And suddenly you have people out of work as well. That's a consequence of these kinds of mandates. And so we got together a coalition of organizations ranging from 60 plus to the American Consumer Institute to Freedom Works and the Taxpayers Protection Alliance to say, we've got to put a halt to this. We can't keep attaching so many strings out there that we actually hurt workers on these contracts instead of help them.
And the real issue is, should a by force union and or the government decide what fair wages are? Or should that be free exchange by individuals and groups that are set up that are not forced in nature, that are not mandated, that are free association organizations? You can literally back this off, but still have that protection. There's a way, and it doesn't mean government force or special privilege, Pete.
Yes, that's right. That's why there's a bill in Congress called the Fair and Open Competition Act that was introduced by a House member, James Comer of Kentucky, and on the Senate side by Todd Young of Indiana. And it would simply say that federal agencies and grantees are not required to sign these project labor agreements as a condition of winning construction contracts.
You gotta love it, ladies and gentlemen. Quickly, which states are best for remote workers, Pete?
Oh, yes. This is what's called the Rome Index, where we have put together, based on several factors, the friendliest states? In other words, do they reach across their borders and tax you even if you're not working there? Do they have reciprocity agreements with other states so you're not double taxed? So we have all kinds of state rankings available. Look at, for example, Montana, look at Maine, look at West Virginia, look at Wisconsin. They are all highly ranked, in other words, good ranked states for remote workers. Take a look at Utah. That ranks number 21. Not a bad place to be. Well, but then there are the bad places. California ranks number 40. Not surprisingly, New York, number 47. They always want their money. But then a few surprises. Nebraska, Arkansas, Mississippi ranked very low on our index. In other words, very poor for remote workers to be.
Where does Texas sit? It's a huge state, too.
Texas ranks really well because they have zero income tax. And that right away means that they have a much harder time reaching across their borders or letting other states reach into their borders and tax remote workers. So if you want to be a remote worker in Texas, you're in pretty good shape there, and you're surrounded by states like Louisiana, which rank pretty well, Arkansas, not so well, Oklahoma, New Mexico, so-so. But it's all together a really good place to be if you're a remote worker.
All right, last topic before we got to let you fly. Bipartisan legislation would cut off pensions to corrupt politicians. Damian Brady with this piece on NTU.org. Pete?
Yeah, this has been a long-standing issue. Lawmakers convicted of serious crimes can still collect taxpayer-funded pensions. We've had two laws in 2007 and 2012 to try to stamp this out, and still they get around it. You know, they don't serve long enough, or the crime they commit is not on the list to deprive them of the pension. This new bill, sponsored by Jackie Rosen, Democrat of Nevada, and Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, would close all the loopholes and would say, if you're a member of Congress and you've been sentenced to jail, you don't get any kinds of appeals. You forfeit your pension. And if you win your appeal later, you get your money back. But you don't get to keep filing appeal after appeal after appeal and keep your pension. This has happened with quite a number of lawmakers, unfortunately.
How likely is this to pass this time? I know you've said we've had two, quote, runs at this in 07 and 12. Do you think that it's going to take off this time?
Yes, I do. I think that this time we have sufficient momentum in both the Democratic and Republican caucuses to finally close this loophole. We've had several attempts, as I said, and I think that this may be the year where members of Congress finally get enough of a sense of shame to go ahead and do it. In fact, we came very close last Congress, and we expect that this will come to a vote on the Senate side pretty soon.
Pete Sepp, thank you so much for your time, sir. Godspeed.
Godspeed, sir. Take care.
There he goes, Mr. Pete Sepp, president of National Taxpayers Union, your partner on the most local level all the way down to the general government level. They can help you with think tank information, with partnership guidance and direction and funding and everything in between. NTU.org. God bless them and their work.
In message one, we said that Satan, the father of lies, John 8:44, gave the left evil, spiritual power the more they use the lies. The political left today is the beast. Now the Bible confirms that the dragon gave him, the beast, his power. Revelation 13:2. The extra evil spiritual power that comes from the beast by their lying is what accounts for the string of the leftist criminals in the government that have never yet been prosecuted. It also explains why American capitalists support communism in the 21st century. Note 1. That behavior of capitalists was predicted by Vladimir Lenin, a cell of the beast. Note 2, Henry Ford was a capitalist, and he would have never gone communist. The difference between Ford and the present-day end-time capitalists is that Ford was born and educated in the Kingdom of Christ, 19th century America, the New Jerusalem, Revelation 21.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm 7 years old. I'm sitting here in the corner having a time out until Mom comes to talk to me. All I did was cut my sister's hair. I was just trying to help. I guess Mom didn't like how I did it. In a minute, she'll be back and ask me if I know what I did was wrong. Maybe I shouldn't have cut her hair. And she'll say we all make mistakes because we're just learning about stuff. Then she'll give me a hug and we'll end up talking about more stuff.
No matter what you talk to your kids about, love is what they'll hear.
I really like Mom's timeouts, and I think she likes them too. Yeah, I think they help her remember how much she loves me.
A thought from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Visit us at Mormon.org.
Back with you live, ladies and gentlemen. Wow. Late breaking headline right now. You know they canceled the grand jury proceedings for the Donald Wednesday in a blow up reality check. They had that witness testify, that attorney that blew everything up, Michael Cohen, questionable testimony. Now this letter from Michael Cohen showing that he swore to the previous courts that, you know what, Donald didn't know about it or give him anything. Now he's reversing that. So the credibility crisis for Cohen taking center stage. But it gets worse now, because now Trump hush money grand jury will not meet for the rest of the week. I guess they're going to meet, but on different topics today. So now they canceled it for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. It's starting to blow up in their face, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. They are fearful now that what's going to happen is this guy, this Bragg guy, if he proceeds with this very, very questionable legal strategy, that he could be in jail. Why? Because the 600 pages of exculpatory evidence that was withheld is now the main focus. What are we going to give jurors? What can the jurors see? What can the jurors know? How much of our legal strategy should we let the jurors find out about? Should he continue with recommending indictments for the Donald to these jurors? Should he not even put it on the table for the jury? What will the jury do with what information? If we let the jury move forward and make decisions without the proper information, then what happens? Will there be a countersuit? What will occur? That is all front and center right now. And the bottom line is this Bragg character and others, they're scrambling. They want the jury just to go home and, or not touch it, focus on something else while they get time to recalibrate their legal strategy. Meanwhile, Donald smirks and submits more explosive witness testimony, destroying all credibility of the witch hunt, etc. Now, sadly, Donald's raising a ton of money. He raised $1.5 million. On this, he was going to be arrested thing. Donald wants this to be a spectacle, because the more of a spectacle it becomes, the more high profile it becomes, the more abusive they are to Donald, that's publicly viewed, if you will, the better position Donald will be in for the 2024 elections. The more Donald gets abused, the more people love him and say, we got to defend against this. Like or dislike Donald, this is uncalled for and wrong, and it's got to stop. So now even Democrats and people that don't even like or agree with Trump in any way are saying, you know what? This is insane. The longer the jury waits, the more the court of public opinion turns against these prosecutors. And now they've already poisoned the well with using Michael Cohen as their star witness. This guy has got a credibility crisis a gazillion miles long. And now the dovetail of this very questionable legal strategy, people are starting to understand it. Let me explain it to you in very simple terms. Cohen paid this chick, Stephanie Clifford, or Stormy Daniels, this porn star, money to keep quiet, says the story. The problem is, Cohen paid money to her. I don't think that's debatable. What's debatable is, did Michael do that on his own? Or was it under instructions from the Donald? That's first. Well, Cohen swore in testimony before in a letter that he did it on his own and Donald knew nothing about it. Neither did Donald's staff. Now he flips 180 degrees and said, no, I was doing the bidding of the Donald. But there's no evidence or proof of that. It's his word against Donald's word. It's his word against his own word. Do you see what a credibility crisis that is for a witness, folks? Wow. In addition now, 600 pages of exculpatory evidence withheld from the defense and the jury. And you go, wait a minute now. And now the plot thickens. What did Donald know versus what he didn't know? And you're not going to be able to prove any of that. Well, the legal strategy is simple. Hey, Donald made payments to a porn star. That's a misdemeanor, no biggie, right? But then they turn around and, well, some of that was used for the campaign. In a very unique way, they turn this now first crime into a second crime. The second crime, if connected to the first crime, would make this misdemeanor a felony, you see, because it's now federal campaign finance violations. But the problem is, you can't even prove Michael Cohen and Donald Trump had an agreement. You can't prove there's fuzzy business dealings there because you can't prove that Donald gave money to Michael in a backhanded way for this purpose. You can't prove that. See, Michael Cohen and Donald were strategically careful enough, whether you like it or not, to where the fixer got it fixed. And the problem is now the fixer's trying to betray Donald, but the fixer was too good. It doesn't matter if Donald paid the porn star or not, or Michael Cohen or anybody else paid the porn star. It doesn't matter. It's not relevant. It's a misdemeanor at best. And then you can't tie that to Michael's business and Donald's business to say there was a payment that's a quid pro quo on this topic. There is no evidence. So that, along with the 600 pages of exculpatory evidence, along with the very tenuous legal strategy, puts Bragg in a bind. And he thought he could move forward with this, but he's got a rude awakening here. And now he's in absolute paranoid scramble mode. I just thought I'd make sure you understood that. All right? The hush money grand jury will not meet for the rest of the week. They're hoping to have something together by Monday that'll make sense. Now, I got another interesting story for you that's very, very, very interesting. It's an exclusive, and it's from the Gateway Pundit. Joe Hoft wrote this article. You know, the Hoft family, I guess, started the Gateway Pundit. But they say it's exclusive. Election system now discovered. Used in multiple states. Did you hear me? A election system is now discovered, used in multiple states. Internet connected, uncertified, and accessible to numerous government agencies and outside entities. Yeah, a team of election experts in the state of New Mexico uncovered an election system that is being used in that state and multiple other states that do not comply with election laws. I'm resting my case on fraud, am I not? Those who claim we make these statements without evidence, listen to me carefully, would you please? Election experts in New Mexico have established, listen, that the post-election canvas reports in all 33 New Mexico counties are being illegally prepared. Complete election records are being uploaded to an uncertified, centralized software under the control of the Secretary of state so-called service, which has been used to create the official election results. It's all illegal. Do you hear me? Use of any uncertified software for the, listen, for this part of the election process is a violation of federal and state law. In other words, it's highly illegal. Yeah, you're not allowed to have any access to any of the election data from any county until the elections have been certified. That's right. According to the experts, when the illegal canvas process is complete, well, I guess Dominion deleted a lot of the information from their systems violating law, because by law it must be kept for 22 months. A South Dakota company by the name of BPRO, that's the letter B as in Bravo, BPRO, gifted their, quote, total vote software to New Mexico in exchange for a series of what would turn out to be very lucrative sole source contracts to develop a customized interface between the SOS clerks and Total Vote. They called the thing Iris. It was renamed Service-Wide State Election Registration and Voting Integrity System. This was done back in 2017, folks, and now it's just being discovered. And you say there's no fraud, huh? Let's dig into BPRO along with Connex, shall we? Wow. According to the BPRO website, Total Vote, that's the software, is a centralized voter registration and election management system that securely captures and manages voter, candidate, and all election information. It's the first time a single-sourced solution has controlled all aspects of the voting process. Wow. Folks, all election information. It is the only software system that encompasses the entire election process into one system. Wow, folks. They don't have any certifications at Total Vote at all. To date, New Mexico has paid BPRO a total of $2,700,000+ in upkeep to use their Total Vote system. From reviewing the contracts, this thing took years to develop, and limited election data is uploaded the night of elections. Anyway, the bottom line is they upload things in batches at different times, then they create this distribution data is available holistically. So in other words, they upload it pieces at a time, and then something happens, and then they make it available for, quote, consumption. But state law only allows for aggregated data, not data from the individual ballots to be used. And the most disturbing part of the discovery is it shows how they're supposed to transfer data to and from the system. U.S. memory sticks and read-only mode are being used to move data from the Dominion server. Yeah. Anyway, why do we need to transfer information to and from? And why is it in read-only mode first and then in read-only write mode later? The corrupted results could be backloaded onto the company's servers this way. The service program is internet connected as well, and contrary to what we've been told about all these systems. They lied. They got caught. More evidence of election fraud in your face, people. This is the one and only Liberty Roundtable Live. We need your funding. LibertyRoundtable.com, LovingLiberty.net.